Outside, as we indicated, about 4,000 demonstrators are present. Here now, the President.
Members of the Economic Club of Detroit, all of your distinguished guests who are with you here tonight, and all of those who are listening on national radio and also on television. I first want to express my appreciation to this distinguished organization for inviting me back. I've appeared on two occasions in other capacities. I am honored to be here for the first time as President of the United States. I particularly appreciate it, too, the warm welcome that not only we have received in this hall, but as we drove in from the airport. The signs the signs that we saw on some of the buildings and all the other various activities that we witnessed were something that we deeply appreciated. Let me say, too, that having spoken to this club on other occasions, I have recognized that the usual format is for the speaker to speak a while and then to answer questions. I know that those members of the club, however, greatly favor the questions and the answers, certainly the questions, more than they favor the speaking. So tonight, I am following the format, a format that all of those listening on radio and television should know. You in the hall have already been informed of making this an entire question period. I will not take the time of the questioners except to pay tribute to some of those who have come from Michigan to Washington to work with this administration and have made contributions to it. They have come with me on the plane tonight. First, to the former governor of this state, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, George Romney. One of the trusted members of our cabinet, a man who is one of my top advisors on domestic matters, and also one who is the driving spirit behind one of the greatest housing booms this country has ever had, with, incidentally, a new high this month as well. And second, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, one of the architects of the new economic policy, Dr. Paul McCracken. And third, from the Congress of the United States, first, the Republican leader of the House, Congressman Gerald Ford from Michigan. A man who has been of enormous assistance to this administration in some of the very close and tough fights we have had on some legislation that seems to have been great interest to the nation, as well as to the people of Michigan. And then on the other side of the Capitol, the man who has served as the whip, the second-ranking Republican of the United States Senate on the Republican side, Senator Bob Griffin. And since this is the motor capital of the world, with some interest in what is going to happen to the excise tax on automobiles, I want this audience to know that of all the people in the House and the Senate who talked to me about that, and some did quite often, he was the most influential of all. We give him the major credit. Now, I would also, of course, at this occasion, point out that it would be hard to find from any state of the Union four men who have made a greater contribution to this administration than those that I have just named from the state of Michigan. We appreciate what the state of Michigan has done for this administration and the nation in the personage of these four men. I also tonight would like to be able to thank the state of Michigan for sending us Alex Karras. George Allen, incidentally, the coach of the Redskins and an old friend of mine from Los Angeles days, asked me to give you his regards when I didn't realize this was going to be a mixed audience, so I can't pass them on at this point. But I do know this, that I noted with interest that before the game at St. Louis last Sunday, that Alex Garris pointed out that he didn't want to go to a team that was a non-contender and didn't have a passer. After what Washington did to St. Louis, I can only say this. We've lost the Senators, but watch out for the Redskins. And now with that, we will go to the questions, and I turn first to the right to Mr. Amon.
Mr. President, this is the first question. It has been reported that you will announce the administration position on phase two of wage price controls by mid-October. It does not seem appropriate to inquire into the nature of those controls at this time, but this question is concerned with longer-term considerations. What is the policy of your administration as to the ultimate elimination of controls and return to the sort of free market economy we had prior to August 15th, and when do you think this may be accomplished?
Well, first, with regard to phase two, it will be announced well before 30 days before the elapsing of the 90-day freeze. Second, as I have indicated, it will be effective. It will cover the whole economy. It will have to concentrate primarily on those areas of the economy, major industries, for example, where there is the greatest possibility of inflationary tendencies having effect on the balance of the economy, but all of the economy will be covered. As far as the duration of phase two is concerned, we are not going to set a limit on it because we believe that its duration should depend upon how effectively it deals with the problem. However, our commitment is to return to the free market forces as the most effective way to move this economy forward. But until we can deal with the problem of inflation, deal with the problem of wages and prices as they force up the cost of living for all Americans, and deal with it effectively, we believe that it is necessary to have controls with teeth backed up by government. And in that respect, while it is going to be also necessary to have voluntary cooperation from management, from labor, and support from the American people, which we presently have in very great volume, it is also essential that there be government sanctions to back it up, and there will be. But having said all these things, our major commitment in the long run is to return this economy as soon as we have cooled the fires of inflation, to return it to those strong free forces that have brought us so far in the period that we have been a free economy. Thank you.
Mr. President, this is a three-part question. You might call it a typically Detroit question. Do you think the automobile contribution is still a major part of the pollution problem? And are the further required emission standards really worth the cost to the consumer? And what cost analysis is being made of automotive safety and emission standards? And why are such cost studies not made prior to the issue of regulations?
I quit beating my wife last week, too. Mr. Boyd, the question is not only pertinent to Detroit, it's pertinent to the whole country. Because when we look at the automobile industry, we realize that it provides one out of six jobs in this country. It also provides an enormous driving force for an economy as we are moving upward at this time. Now, with regard to the emission standards, I understand that Mr. Ruckelshaus, working with industry in the Detroit area, will have an announcement in the next few days with regard to a new engine that in preliminary tests meets the very strict standards of the Clean Air Act. Whether that is an indication that we will be able to go further along that line remains to be seen, because the 50,000-mile test has not yet been passed. On the second point, it is vitally important that in this whole area of the environment, whether it's in the area of water pollution or air pollution or any other area, that more attention must be given to the cost factor as well as to the factor that we're all interested in of cleaning up our air and cleaning up our water. I believe that, as far as this administration is concerned, as a result of the direction I have given to the Environmental Protection Agency, that we are bringing more balance into that program. Let's just understand one thing. We all want clean air and clean water. And sometimes I have heard people say, wouldn't it be great if we could go back to the way America was in the beginning? Wouldn't it be great if we didn't have all of this great industrialization that pollutes our air and pollutes our water? And the answer is not at all. I've been in countries that have no industrialization. I've been in countries that have very few automobiles. And let me say, I'd rather live in the United States of America. I think what we have to realize is that when the Congress or an administration carrying out the will of a Congress sets certain standards to clean up the air or clean up the water, we must weigh against that how many jobs is it going to cost. And if it's going to cost a disproportionate number of jobs for what good it is going to be able to accomplish, then we have to reevaluate the decision. Now, I have talked generally to your questions because it seems to me that it is important not to be more precise than that, since some of these matters, as you know, will be the subject of directives in the future. I simply want you to know, however, that weighing these matters, balancing these things, is very much in my mind and in the minds of those carrying out the policy of this administration. We are committed to cleaning up the air and cleaning up the water, but we are also committed to a strong economy, and we are not going to allow the environmental issue to be used, sometimes falsely and sometimes in a demagogic way, basically to destroy the system, the industrial system that made this the great country that it is.
Mr. President, would it not be desirable for your administration to launch a comprehensive campaign to educate the entire American public, including some politicians and perhaps some labor leaders, that the most effective creator of jobs is growth in corporation profits?
Incidentally, so that the members of our television audience and radio audience will know, we do have a labor leader here tonight, and so we have both represented. And I realize that as I talk out there to the television audience in the Detroit area and to the radio audience across the country, that there will be many who represent the areas from labor as well as those from management. Now, to say anything for profits before this audience is like the preacher talking to the choir. And to be very candid with you, there are a lot more votes in being against profits, in being for controlling profits, than there are in being for it. But let me talk, if I may, not just to this panel and not just to this group of business leaders and some labor leaders and education leaders here, but let me talk to those people in the Detroit area and across this country who are thinking about, how do we get more jobs in America? How does our system really work? Now, first, with regard to our freeze, when you control prices and costs, there is automatically some control on profits. Second, when there is control of prices and costs, the only way that there can be more profits is for the industry involved to expand. And that means more jobs. And we think that's good. Now, the second point that should be borne in mind is, who are those who get the profits? Who benefits from profits? Well, first, the government is the major beneficiary. $1 of every $2 in corporate profits goes to the government. We wouldn't have the money, for example, for education, to help the poor, the poverty programs, all the rest, unless it were the fact that we had profits of which 50% go to the federal government for its taxes. And then there are 100 million Americans who share in profits, either as stockholders, as members of mutual funds, or who are beneficiaries of profits in one way or another. And beyond that, the major reason that profits are essential to a strong, growing economy is this. Where are jobs going to come from? How is it going to be possible for the American worker who receives, and we hope this will always be the case, the highest wage in the world, real wage, approximately twice as much as his next competitor in the world, how is it going to be possible for him to compete with other workers in the world? Only if he has the equipment, the machinery, the organization that gives him a competitive advantage over those from abroad. Where do we get that? It is only through profits that industry can buy the new plant, the new equipment that will make our workers more productive and therefore more competitive in the world. And so, putting it quite bluntly, let me say, I am for profits because I believe that more profits means more jobs. And at this particular time, we need more jobs. It's very easy to say, let's control profits, let's limit profits, let's have an excess profits tax. And of course, the argument for saying that is that you're taking care of the big man and helping the little man. But when you really look at what makes this economy work, when you really look at what produces jobs, it comes from profits being plowed back into industry and making American workers thereby more competitive and thereby producing more jobs. And I'm for that, and I think every American would be for it if he understood it that way. Turn to Mr. Younglove of the...
Mr. President, I was told we could interrupt that if you
could
explain, so I'd just like to say this. I'm sure that the labor movement and the leaders of the labor movement want to see companies and corporations make good profits, but we are concerned about the corporations that make fantastic profits, such as, let's take the finance industry. I don't know what productivity the finance industry gives to the American people, except huge profits to themselves, and also take the drug industry. Again, here is an industry that makes fantastic profits, and I could go on with many other ones. And it just seems to me that this is where we're talking about. The labor movement feels that if there was going to be a freeze on wages, then there ought to have been a freeze in some of these areas, not cutting profits down to where companies couldn't modernize their plants and couldn't go forward, because I agree with you that if we don't have modern equipment, then we can't compete with other people and other lands, and they certainly have got them. So I do feel that we are for it, but at the same time, I think we ought to look at the exorbitant profit areas.
Well, Mr. Younglove, as a representative of the steel union, one of the strongest unions, as we know, I think that you have, of course, very properly recognized that the interests of a union leader and of, obviously, his membership is to deal with a profitable corporation. I would say heaven help the labor leader that's trying to make a good contract with a corporation that's losing money. It's better to have one that's making profits. Now, second, I think it's particularly helpful that you pointed up the need for profits being plowed back into businesses so that we could be more competitive. For example, look at steel. We find that steel today, and you know this is the case, in Japan, in Germany, some of the most modern steel plants in the world, perhaps the most modern one in Japan. Now, we should not resent that, but I say, let's see that the American steel industry makes enough profit so that it can be competitive and your members can be competitive with the steel workers of Japan and Germany. Now, when we try to pick out this segment or that segment of the economy, you've named the finance industry, bankers, I presume, and that'd be an easy one to be against because there are a lot more borrowers than there are bankers. But let me say that, Mr. Young, let's talk about interest rates for a moment. Why don't we limit interest rates? Well, if you've ever gone to a bank, it's sort of like you can drive the horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And applying that to a banker, you can limit the interest rates, but you can't make the banker loan the money. So when you come to this matter of interest rates, it isn't just a question of limiting the interest. It's a question of providing some system under which the money that is needed for a growing economy is forthcoming. Now, your great financial institutions, it's true, have made profits. But it's also true that since this freeze began, interest rates have come down. Not a great deal, but they have come down. We want them to continue to come down. As far as the general principle, however, of looking around the economy, and once we see a very successful business making a profit, say, because you're successful, we're going to penalize you by limiting your profit. I don't think that's good for America. I think we ought to reward success rather than to penalize it.
Mr. President, your DISC proposal will help American export of goods and therefore create and retain the jobs of American workers. But is this enough to restore our normal trade surplus in this competitive world today, or is additional help to our exports needed to balance the aid that other countries like Japan give to their exporters?
Well, Mr. Kershaw, this is a subject to which we have given a great deal of attention through Mr. Peterson's new Council on International Economic Affairs, which you're probably familiar with. First, let me refer to that section of our new economic policy which directly attacks this problem. We have applied a 10% surcharge on imports from abroad. Now, in applying that surcharge, however, I have indicated that we must not look upon it as being a permanent wall around the United States. A permanent wall of tariff barriers and of quotas around the United States would be good short-term policy and disastrous long-term policy. It'd be bad for the consumers of this country by raising their prices. It'd be bad by the producers of this country because we wouldn't be competitive. The United States producer simply wants an equal shot, an equal chance. Now, insofar as removing that surcharge is concerned, we are not going to be belligerent. We're not trying to declare war on the other great trading nations. The United States is proud of the role it's played over the past 25 years in proceeding to assist the whole system of international economic cooperation. But at this point, the nations that were on their backs 25 years ago, our allies in Europe, as well as those who were against us, the Germans, are now on their feet and competing with us. The same is true of the Japanese in Asia. We're glad that we helped to make it possible for them to compete with us. But at this point, it is also essential that that competition be one where it is fair for American business and where their business people will not have advantages that we do not have. Now, that means that we need a new approach to the problem of exchange rates. We need a new system. The other one was crisis prone. And that is one of the reasons why the surcharge will not be removed until we get action on that front. It means also that we need to reduce some of those impediments, artificial barriers to American goods abroad. All that we want there is fair and free trade for our goods, just as we hope we can provide fair and free trade for theirs. We come finally to the basic point. Can American producers compete with others in the world without some subsidy? It may be necessary in some areas that there be subsidy, and we should consider that. We have got to see to it that the American workman, the highest paid workman in the world, is not driven out of competition because an unfair advantage is obtained by a workman abroad who is paid less because his government subsidizes him and our government doesn't subsidize ours. It is subsidy only in that area that we would favor it. But generally, the hope of the future and the hope of America is in a new system which will be fair and which will be free through reducing barriers rather than to have more artificial barriers. Mr. Hastings.
Mr. President, the American Institutes of Architects is preparing recommendations for national urbanization policy
which we believe is compatible with your national growth policy. Central to our recommendations is the use of a national transportation system to implement such a policy. Would you, Mr. President, feel disposed to support a proposal that the Highway Trust Fund expand its general transportation into a general transportation fund in order to build such a national transportation system?
Well, Mr. Hastings, as you're probably quite aware, you've hit upon about one of the most sensitive political issues we have in this country. I just met with a group of governors, incidentally, enlisting their support, and we have their support in support of the wage price freeze. And if there is one sensitive issue that Governor Milliken will tell you, as he even says it in his state, it's, what are you going to do about that highway trust fund? We have, the same is true with regard to the Congress. On the other hand, looking toward a comprehensive transportation problem policy for the country, I believe that we cannot be rigid with regard to the Highway Trust Fund. I believe that if the only effective way of solving our mass transit problems, our problems of congestion and the rest, is through some approach which would use some of these funds in other directions, I think we have to consider it. I don't have a specific proposal before me, and until I have one, I of course will not approve it, but I don't think we should enter this problem with a closed mind.
Mr. President, this question perhaps calls for an answer along the lines of the educational one suggested earlier. In your opinion, sir, is it impossible for the United States government to limit its spending to the amount of its income and forget deficit budgeting as a way of life?
I would answer the question by saying that whenever our economy is producing at full capacity, we should under no circumstances spend more than what the tax system produces. In other words, we should always have a budget which is balanced when our economy is producing at full capacity. When our economy is not producing at full capacity, however, it has been true at least in the last 25 years, and this was true even in the Eisenhower administration in 1958 when we had a deficit of over $10 billion. It has been true that government spending to pick up the slack in the economy can be justified. Now, let's look at this administration. In our first year, in our first 2 years, as a matter of fact, we submitted budgets and lived within budgets that were relatively balanced or close to balance. This year, and in the year 1972, fiscal 1972, our budgets are out of balance. They're out of balance in the conventional way, out of balance in the sense that we are spending more than we are getting in taxes. But on the other hand, they are balanced in another way. We are limiting our spending, with the cooperation of the Congress, we hope, to what the tax system would produce if it were at producing at full employment. And we believe that that kind of spending is not inflationary. If it goes beyond that, then it would be inflationary. So my answer to your question is that what we want to do, and I hope we achieve this goal soon, is to get this economy back to full capacity without war, to have full employment, and when we have that, we can have a balanced budget in a conventional sense.
Mr. President, what are your administrative policies and practices to combat discrimination and segregation in housing in cities and suburbs to do two things? First, to reduce the necessity of school busing, and secondly, to increase the employment of minority persons in suburban firms and factories through a rapid transit system.
Well, Mr. Carnegie, we have a number of policies in this area which Governor Romney could perhaps describe in greater detail than I could on this program. You, of course, are aware of the fact that through the Philadelphia Plan and through a number of other initiatives, we have opened up job opportunities for minority groups that haven't existed before. We also have opened up business opportunities through our initiatives in the field of minority business that have not existed before. With regard to housing, we have followed the practice, which we think is a proper one, of seeing that there is an equal opportunity for all individuals, regardless of race, to have a chance to move into any housing. We have enforced the law, and we will continue to enforce the law in that respect. Now, when you go to a further point, the point I think that you suggest, or you may be suggesting, that we should use the power of the federal government to force so-called integrated housing, I would respectfully suggest that that kind of a program would not be workable, and it is not one that I think can be justified. We will, of course, not subsidize through the federal government and do not housing that is segregated. But on the other hand, to go to the other extreme and to use the power of the government to change housing patterns, change them forcibly, rather than to have those patterns changed on a voluntary basis by having an open housing program in which any individual who has the opportunity can move where he wants. We believe that that kind of an approach of a forced housing policy is one that will not work.
Mr. President, there's all the questions submitted and seem to have an inordinate preoccupation with the interest rates. So the primary question here is, what will the policy of Phase 2 be with regard to interest rates?
Well, as you know, interest rates are not covered in the freeze. With regard to Phase 2, the matter is still open, particularly with regard to loans affecting consumers. As you know, through the Federal Reserve, there are some tools that are available in that respect. We have not yet made a decision with regard to interest rates, and I would say that what happens to interest rates for the balance of Phase 1, whether they continue to, shall we say, stay where they are or go down, will have a great deal of effect on whether we feel it is necessary to have the Federal Reserve move in with the power that they have, particularly at the consumer level, on interest rates in Phase 2.
Mr. President.
Mr. Whale.
As you know, the cities of our country have many critical problems, one of which is an antiquated welfare system that is very bad from everyone's point of view, the recipient, the caseworker, and the public. What can we look to as your role, and what action can we expect in resolving this problem in the frame of reference of your new economic program?
Well, as you know, Mr. Winkleman, one of the major initiatives of this administration, one that we've had before the Congress now for over a year, almost a year and a half, has been a massive welfare reform. The present welfare system is a national disgrace. It is a system which makes it more profitable for a man to go on welfare than to go to work. That is why our system... That is why the key to our welfare reform proposal is to provide for the working poor an opportunity for individuals to move off welfare, even to lower paid jobs, so that they can, rather than to have a disincentive to work. We want to remove the incentives to stay on welfare. We want to increase the incentives to get off welfare and to work. And we want to get away, too, from the present system, and that's what our family assistance program is also directed to, the present system, which I think is unconscionable, of having welfare snoopers going around to enforce what I think is the unenforceable provisions of the present welfare system. Now, with regard to that welfare program, as far as the president is concerned and the administration, we have laid it before the Congress. I have emphasized it in every speech. I emphasized it again when I spoke to the Congress on September 9th. It has passed the House. It is now before the Senate. And I...
You're listening to President Nixon answering questions put to him in Detroit by members of the Detroit Economic Club. In the first 40 minutes or so, the president said there would be no limit on the duration of Phase 2 of the wage price control controls, that is to say, the phase which will follow the conclusion of the 90-day freeze on wages and prices, November 13th. He said there would be no limit on the duration until we have dealt with inflation effectively. He said there will be government sanctions in Phase 2 to back up whatever restraints there are to be on wages and prices. He said, however, that we will return to a free economy when the fires of inflation have cooled. He was asked about profits, the lack of restraints or controls at the moment on profits. He said there would certainly be a lot more votes in talking about controlling profits. But he again turned down any restraint on profits because he said they are essential to a strong, growing economy and they create jobs. I believe more profits mean more jobs, he said. He was challenged by a steelworkers union official who cited allegedly fantastic profits in the finance and drug industries, which do not produce more jobs. But the president insisted the companies not making a good profit do not employ people. He noted that since the freeze began, interest rates have come down, that in reference to banks. And also, he said, as a matter of basic philosophy, we reward success. We do not penalize it.